Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. So, businessman Elon Musk, who says he doesn't believe in censorship, and who also happens to be the richest man in the world, has made a deal to buy the very influential social media platform Twitter. And leftist true believers and anti-white zealots are spitting and raging that they won't be able to shut down racially conscious whites anymore. In very guarded language, Twitter's former longtime boss, Jack Dorsey, is hinting that he supports Musk and deplored the censorious regime that he, in fact, presided over. Very strange. Twitter's board was frantic to keep Musk at bay one day, then unanimously accepted his purchase of the company the next day. Stranger yet. No one knows for sure if Musk will succeed in taking the company private. But there are some things we do know. We do know that Musk once gave an interview in which he seemed a lot less concerned with free speech than he has been lately, saying, quote, "Twitter should match the laws of the country," close quote. Which, considering all the countries in which the platform operates, and considering that right here in the U.S., the Department of Homeland Security, under the Jew Alejandro Mayorkas, is setting up a new disinformation governance board, may mean something close to zero free speech on racial matters. I do wonder how stupid our enemies have to be to give the Disinformation Governance Board a name like that. It sounds like they're the source and managers of all the disinformation out there, which probably isn't too far from the truth. Maybe they're rubbing our faces in it. As one wit put it, the same people who tell us that men can get pregnant want the power to stop misinformation. The Disinformation Governance Board will be headed by Nina Jankowicz, a millennial who is married to someone named Michael Stein and who has been rapidly ascending the ladder of establishment endorsement and visibility after serving in the post-coup Jewish government of Ukraine in 2016. Global fellowships, op-eds and puff pieces in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and a lot more. By the way, Mayorkas, who likes to masquerade as being a Cuban, is neither Cuban nor Spanish, but a descendant of Jews who were resident in Romania and the Ottoman Empire. We do know that Musk, who certainly could have paid for Twitter with his own money, made a sudden decision not to do so, and instead obtained loans to the tune of $25 billion from the likes of Morgan Stanley, Barclays Bank, Bank of America, and several more of the usual suspects. So, will Musk really have a free hand once he becomes the owner? Did his submission to effectively partnering with our banker and merchant friends signal to Twitter's board that Musk would keep the platform safely in anti-white hands? I would say, time will tell, but this is America, the country where the real reasons for things are nearly always hidden, and the ostensible reasons are almost never the real reasons. So, time may tell is as far as I'm willing to go. The Jewish point of view on Musk's takeover bid, a twisted, contradictory Talmudic point of view, was expressed in an article posted at Israel Today, a publication intended mainly for Jews. The title and subtitle alone tell the story. Quote, "Israel congratulates Elon Musk on acquiring Twitter, defending free speech. But Jewish state hopes the tech visionary and world's richest man can help stifle the growing anti-Semitism and incitement against Jews on social media." Close quote. What? How can you stifle people and at the same time defend free speech? Only a Jew could originate such a thought or have the effrontery to parade it in public. The Israel Today piece quotes a tweet from Yoaz Hendel, the Jewish state's communications minister, who said, quote, "Congrats to Elon Musk on reaching an agreement to acquire Twitter. Looking forward to a new era of free speech. Yet, no less importantly, we in Israel hope we can also recognize and combat anti-Semitism and incitement to violence against Jews and the State of Israel on social media swiftly and when it happens. It's a matter of life and death." Close quote. That, my friends, is how Jews think. Of course, there are a lot of corollary thoughts of theirs that they don't like to expose in public. The boss of the crime-linked Jewish ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, says he's worried about Musk buying Twitter. He spoke to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, quote, "Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan Greenblatt on Monday warned that Elon Musk's $44 billion acquisition of Twitter could lead to a rise in anti-Jewish extremism. We know firsthand that hate and extremism in digital spaces can lead to physical violence, particularly against Jews and other marginalized communities," Greenblatt said. "Twitter has made some strides in tackling this hate in recent years. So while we want to be cautiously optimistic about how Elon Musk will run the platform, he hasn't demonstrated any focus on these issues to date. We worry he could take things in a very different direction," he added. Greenblatt noted that, as a private company, Twitter will lack the transparency and accountability of a public firm. Close quote. Greenblatt went on to rant about this being a sad day for democracy. Quote, "It strikes me as deeply troubling and potentially dangerous that two people, Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, essentially control the public square. Seems like a sad day for democracy." Close quote. Zuckerberg is the racially disloyal Jew, married to an Asian, who owns Facebook. Funny, isn't it, that Greenblatt was well pleased with censorious Twitter and thought that their lack of transparency and accountability was just fine as long as his friends were in charge. Back to the Haaretz piece, quote, "In its 2021 online anti-Semitism report card, the ADL noted Twitter earned the highest ranks for data accessibility through their application programming interface that enables researchers to study the prevalence of anti-Semitism on the platform. It also noted, however, that Twitter had not taken action on content ADL reported through ordinary user channels, though it did so through its Trusted Flagger program." Close quote. Good Lord, it's never enough for the Jews. The lesson here is that Jews don't care about free speech, though they will pretend to do so when necessary, to advance their self-interested agenda. It's becoming more and more obvious. Before they came to full power in this country, though, they were the ones screaming loudest for free speech, for communists and race mixers and pornographers and perverts. That was when they were trying to displace the old white establishment with themselves and take over our beloved America. Now that they have their power, now that they have taken over, free speech is something they hate very much. They don't want anyone who criticizes or even points out their extremely dangerous and totally illegitimate power over us to be allowed to speak. In truth, they don't want us breathing air. Thus, their increasingly obvious campaign to eliminate the white race. They pretended to befriend sincere free speech advocates, classical liberals and the like, back in the last century. But the Jews are no one's friends. They'll ditch you in an instant, 5 milliseconds after it becomes to their advantage to do so. Last year, a Jew named Leonard Milberg produced an art exhibit featuring, among other things, a couple of 19th century Jewish artists, Theodore Moisey and Moses Ezekiel, who also happened to have been Confederate soldiers. Princeton canceled the show after a firestorm of protests, much of it from other Jews. Milberg wrote that, quote, "Ezekiel, who fought in the Confederate Army as a teenager with his Virginia Military Institute classmates, also sculpted the Confederate Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery," close quote. Interestingly, Ezekiel, with talent rare for a Jew, created art very much in the Aryan tradition of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, very unlike the modern anti-art that Jews produced and promoted, starting just a few years later and still continuing today. Jews were quite prominent in the Confederacy. Jews were fully integrated into the business and governmental establishments of the Old South. They acted and portrayed themselves as fully on the side of white Southerners in keeping the feral black population under control. When the first Ku Klux Klan Night Riders were fighting off the depredations of blacks and the anti-white military dictatorships imposed on the South under Reconstruction, Jews were among Klan leaders and officials. As I noted on this program in 1995, with reference to Jewish whistleblower Benjamin Friedman, quote, "Benjamin H. Friedman was born in 1890, and by an ironic twist of fate, the delivering physician at his birth was Dr. Simon Baruch, the father of arch-conspirator against America, Wall Street speculator and advisor and handler of U.S. presidents from World War I to 1965, Mr. Bernard M. Baruch." Close quote. Interestingly, the elder Baruch was a surgeon in the Confederate Army. When prominent Jew and B'nai B'rith official Leo Frank was arrested in Atlanta as the rapist and murderer of a 13-year-old child laborer, Mary Fagan, in 1913, the Jews directing Frank's legal team mounted a defense that hoped to utilize the all-white jury's low opinion of blacks in an effort to get a not guilty verdict for Frank. They tried to frame two blacks, Newt Lee and Jim Conley, for the crime, freely calling it a, quote, "nigger crime," unquote, in court, and even browbeating a witness over his ability, quote, "to smell a Negro," close quote. But the ploy didn't work. The jury, aware as they doubtless were of Negro criminality, and as pro-Jewish as most Southern Christians still are, was nevertheless fair and honorable, and convicted the obviously guilty Frank, basing their decision partly on the testimony of a black who worked under Frank. I believe that their failure to get their man off by cashing in their friend of the white man chips in the Leo Frank case was a turning point for Jews. After due consideration, they decided to switch sides. And an examination of Jewish activities shows them increasingly, then totally, proclaiming themselves to be allies of non-whites in their efforts to take power and wealth and ultimately even life away from whites. I think one motive in closing down the exhibition featuring the Confederate Jewish artists is that, in the disgusting age of Floyd, they don't want the Jews' former association with the old white supremacist establishment given too much publicity, showing too many folks that Jews switch sides whenever it seems good for Jews to do so, is a bad look in 2022. Right now, Jews are mostly delighted with their alliance with the blacks and browns, who they use as a weapon against whites. But you may be sure that when the moment is right, the Jews will toss their allies to the wolves as soon as they see a benefit for Jews in doing so. They are no one's friends.